Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you for tuning in. We appreciate you hanging out with us for the afternoon. This program is sponsored in part by the American Federation of Government Employees and the United Steelworkers, both internationals. We appreciate all of their support. And let's see, right now we're talking with Jake Rosenfeld. He's with the Economic Policy Institute. Jake, welcome back.
Thanks so much. Glad to be on.
Always a pleasure. We appreciate it, Jake. Decline in union density in the United States is costing non-union workers $133 billion annually in lost wages.
That's right. That's the result of this recent report that I co-authored, and it's the first study that provides a really broad estimate of the wage decline specifically for non-union workers as a result of the decline of unions throughout the private sector.
You know, Jake, I got to tell you, I can hear all of our friends at ALEC and the National Right to Work Foundation just collectively having a stroke when you put this one out there. Well done, sir.
Thank you. I've heard from some of them already.
I'm sure you have. Why are you telling the truth? Yeah. So now, you know, I let me see if I follow this because I, you know, if you're a union worker, you're making X amount of dollars and cents every year. You've got about 20% more disposable income than a non-union worker.
That's right.
You know, and I'm not going to put it down in the Cayman Islands. I don't even understand that kind of stuff. So I'm probably, you know, instead of holding on to my truck for another 3 years, I'm going to get a new truck. And
right.
That's going to put some money into the local butcher, baker, and candlestick maker in my community. Am I right?
I think that's absolutely right. And there are, you know, there are a variety of channels through which strong unions, high union densities in your particular industry, your particular region, helps out non-union workers.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly one of them. Another one is if you're a non-union employer who wants to stay that way, one tried and true tactic to keep unions out is to treat your workers well.
Yes.
And when unions are strong, that threat effect really really had some bite to it.
Right. You know, and I read somewhere that the average anti-union campaign for a small to medium-sized business was in excess of $1 million.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I think that speaks to why, you know, it speaks, I think, largely to the importance of, from the employer perspective, of the anti-union employer of keeping unions out. And, you know, this is a study here that we were kind of taken aback by some of the findings. We thought we'd find an effect. The size of the effects were just astonishing to us. And, you know, we did everything we could to kind of control for and adjust for some of the other dominant explanations for wage stagnation over the last couple of decades.
Jake, you know, part of this interesting thing for me is, you know, we've had some fairly serious, substantial, definable, measurable experiences recently in Seattle at SeaTac.
Uh-huh.
The SeaTac community, the board there, or the community decided, you know, $15 an hour is what we believe is a fair, reasonable, and rational minimum wage. And there were some businesses that fought back against that. And I think maybe they fought back against that out of fear.
Right.
And they were not successful in fighting back against that. And 6 months later, a year later, those same businesses are enjoying stellar growth.
Right.
They're looking for bigger facilities to move their restaurants into. How come we're not hearing in the press and the media about the wonderful things that pay raise did?
Right. A couple of factors there. I think one, that it's still a little bit early. We're getting the results back. It's certainly true that the initial results out of SeaTac and out of the greater Seattle area doesn't show certainly the doomsday scenario that opponents of the Fight for 15 were putting forth. It's a high growth area for a number of reasons right now. But I think we're seeing all these experiments play out across the many states and municipalities and cities in this country, where we'll have a better sense of whether these wage increases can be can result in positive economic benefits down the line. It will take a little bit more time, but it's great that these experiments are going on right now.
Jake, let me ask you a question. Back in 1914, Henry Ford decided that he was going to pay his assembly line workers $5 a day. At that point in time, that was an unheard of wage, especially for assembly line workers. Henry Ford was not known by any stretch of the imagination as a friend of labor, as a friend of the working people.
Right.
But the impact of that and the reason for him doing that, well, the impact is one thing, but his reasoning for doing that was he figured that if he paid his employees well, that right. would enrich in the community where his employees were, and that would help and allow other people in the community to buy his products. I mean, it worked then.
Right.
Why is it that we have individuals within the business community saying, well, that's not going to work today?
Right. It's a key question on the mind of many economists and other analysts. You know, that high road approach to your employees, it still exists out there in pockets and certain companies, but it's fallen by the wayside for many others where they've taken a low road approach and trying to kind of gut wages, bring them down as low as possible, and along with benefit packages. I think we might be starting to see somewhat of a reversal. I think we've seen developments in the last couple of years that are really promising from the perspective of working men and women, but it's going to take a long time to catch up to where we were, certainly in the decades immediately following World War II, where you had real gains going to the middle class in this country.
And the middle class is very important. The middle class is very important for a number of different reasons. But one of them is they're not the working poor. So they have a little bit of disposable income that they can spend on products.
Right.
And they are not the ultra wealthy that are going to try and, you know, hide their funds and resources in the Cayman Islands or elsewhere.
Right.
So that money stays here in the United States, and it gets bounced around through the community. Is that the only factor, or are there other factors that enhance what the middle class can do as a purchasing agent?
I think you've really hit it pretty well. That the middle class is absolutely key to economic prosperity through its purchasing power. But it's also key for economic mobility, because having a broad-based middle class that can kind of set aside some money to pay for their kids' education, that can kind of guarantee mobility through the next generation, something that we've seen stagnate as inequality has really run amok in this country over the past couple of decades.
Well, there you go. Jake, anything else we should take away from this today?
I encourage everyone to go online at the Economic Policy Institute and download the report.
And are you on Twitter?
I am, at Jake Rosenfeld 1.
And if you include us at The Union Edge, we'll retweet this for you. We appreciate you being with us today. And, Jake, keep up the great work, because, like I said, those folks at ALEC and those folks at the National Right to Work for Less Foundation, they just can't take the truth.
All right. I appreciate it. Have a great one.
We appreciate it. Jake Rosenfeld, the Economic Policy Institute. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio.